First of all, you're looking good in this album photo with Pacifica.
Oh, thanks.
No one can tell that you're 4'10".
Compared to you, everyone looks like they're 4'10".
This is fair. Welcome back to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. I'm your producer and host, Ben Finan, director of content at Steinway & Sons and editor-in-chief of the online music magazine, listenmusicculture.com. If you enjoy Soundboard, please rate, review, and subscribe to it wherever you pod your casts. My guest today is Anthony McGill, principal clarinet of the New York Philharmonic. He is the first African-American principal of the orchestra since its founding in 1842. McGill maintains a dynamic international solo and chamber music career, and his latest release with the Pacifica Quartet is American Stories on Sedia Records. Anthony, last time we spoke, we were eating expensive but excellent Wiener Schnitzel in the Mitte district of Berlin, and we were discussing Beethoven symphonies.
That sounds really fancy.
We're talking Beethoven, as dorks do, and I said that I'm an odd-numbered symphony guy, 3, 5, 7, 9. Those are my jams. And you said, no, you're wrong. Even numbers are where it's at because they have the best clarinet parts.
Yeah, you're definitely wrong about that. So I'm glad you've come into the light because you went back, I'm sure, and listened to all the famous recordings, and you were like, you know, there is a clarinet playing in those symphonies, actually.
Well, here's what I did realize from that convo, which is you probably approach concert repertoire from the perspective of a clarinetist. So I guess what I'd like to know first off is what concert rep, when it rolls around, as a principal clarinetist, do you get especially excited to play?
Okay, I have a short list. That's not very hard because these are the greatest pieces ever written, just for the record, again. Respighi, Pines of Rome is one of them. I know that's your favorite work, symphonic repertoire. Rachmaninoff's Second Symphony, that's your second favorite piece, I'm sure. And, oh gosh, actually the list is kind of long. It's not a short list. Sibelius' First Symphony is another great one. Basically, Kodály Dances of Galanta, any symphony or symphonic work with a clarinet solo that lasts more than a few minutes is a candidate for this honor. Yeah, not embarrassed to say. But those are pretty good works.
I'm going to revisit with the ear of a clarinetist and have another listen from the woodwind angle. I have a general idea of what a concertmaster does, I think, in the context of the orchestra.
Okay.
In the context of the orchestra of the New York Philharmonic, what are your musical and extra musical duties as principal clarinetist?
Well, my musical duties are to play the aforementioned clarinet solos in the repertoire. And, you know, to be fair, a lot of the wind parts are soloistic. They're kind of like the soloists of the orchestra, you know, sitting back in the back, but we get a chance to shine. And so we kind of get to play a lot of these gorgeous melodies, and then the strings take over and play their melodies the entire piece, of course. You know, so my job is to play all of those, and it's usually in a section of about 4 players, and some of the repertoire just has 2 clarinets. But yeah, so my part is the solo part in that group. And extra musically, I kind of assign the parts for the year in the orchestra. So depending on what piece we're playing, like I said, we may have 2 clarinets playing, or we'll have 4 or 5 or sometimes 6 clarinets playing, depending on which instruments each person in the section plays. So there's a bass clarinetist. Obviously, the bass clarinetist will play the bass clarinet part. E-flat player will play the E-flat part. But if there is some rotation, meaning that if the associate player, the associate principal player is usually also the E-flat clarinet player, they often play some short pieces on the first half of the program, for instance. So I will go through all of the repertoire for the year and kind of divvy up some of those rotations within the section. That's about it. I mean, you know, everyone kind of does their own thing. You know, everyone can handle their parts and their music. So there isn't that much conversation that happens in orchestra. But when there is, it's like, okay, let's try this one section so we can sound good on it, you know, for a rehearsal or in the performance. You usually don't have to say very much because everyone kind of plays well. So if something is a little off intonation wise or anything, then we kind of work on it very briefly at the end of rehearsal or during a break. And I mean, work on it, meaning we play it a couple times. We get it. We try to get it right. And then we see it at the concert.
That's interesting. I like this statement. Everyone plays well. So you're not breaking out for sectionals the way I did in high school band with the percussion section, right?
No, not really. I mean, I'm really lucky because, you know, I get to play with really great players. So I think trust is a really important part of leading any section, but also just being a part of any section in an orchestra, is that you trust that everyone is trying to sound good. Everyone generally is practicing to do so. And when it's not happening, it's a combination of all of us, you know, that need to work on something. So it's never like, you're out of tune. No, it's usually like, we just need to adjust our pitch so we're playing together in the right place. It's not so difficult. I mean, it's not one of those situations where in the old days where section members didn't talk for 30, 40 years or anything like that. No one wants that.
I've heard old stories like that.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the NFL, right? The coach doesn't have to give a halftime locker room speech. These guys are motivated and they came to play and they've worked their butts off to be in the position that they're in. So extra motivation, whether it's positive or negative, is not going to be required at this level, I would think.
No, not really. I mean, I think if anyone is kind of in charge of that coach position, it would be the music director or the conductor on the podium. And no one wants to be talked to like they're a music director when you're playing in a clarinet section by another clarinetist. That doesn't go over so well.
As a principal, do you have a special direct relationship with your conductor / music director wherein he might give you information that you would transmit to the rest of the players? Or is it, like you just said, no news is good news when coming from the podium?
Oh, totally. No news is definitely good news. I think, yes, I would be the conduit. I guess if there was an issue that needed to be addressed, that would be the flowchart of that information. But conductors often talk directly from the podium to anybody in the orchestra that they would like to. Mm-hmm. It's unnecessary to kind of have to say, you know, well, the conductor really wants me to tell you this. It's usually pretty obvious and stated clearly.
So there's parity at this point. Once you're at the big show, in this case, the New York Philharmonic, anybody can talk to anyone on a peer-to-peer level.
Yeah, generally I'd say so. Yeah, it's a pretty, and maybe I think different orchestras have different vibes. And, you know, like every other orchestra, we've had periods where it's been like kind of probably rocky in the past. You know, people were different at the workplace back in the day. But now I think pretty much everyone can kind of talk to each other about different issues that are going on. And that usually works out. There's no, you're not writing letters or sending emails to each other. It's trying to explain, you know, how we're not playing together in this one spot. At least I hope people aren't doing that.
You, Anthony, are the first African-American principal in the history of the New York Philharmonic, which was founded in 1842, yeah, for a sense of history here. Your brother, Damari, is the principal flute of the Seattle Symphony. Now, there are not a lot of Black folks in the audience at the Philharmonic either. Black absence, of course, is not limited to classical music. I remember going to a Red Sox game at Fenway, and I immediately, as a white dude, still felt how white it was. And I remember saying to my friend, hey, let's find a minority. Ready, set, go. And it took us a few minutes, you know, in a packed stadium. I took Steinway artist Robert Glasper once to see Steinway artist Billy Joel at MSG. And Robert said to me, I'm the only brother here. And I think that made him genuinely sad in the sense of, man, why aren't more Black guys down with Billy Joel? Now, I am not a white man who asks his Black guests to speak on behalf of an entire group of people. But if you have any personal thoughts you'd like to share about Black representation in classical music, I would love to hear them. And I just want to say, from where I sit, I think it's important. I think it's important that you are who you are and are a principal and are visible in what is widely regarded as our nation's top orchestra?
Yeah, thanks for this question. I think the question would be, how much time do we have? Because, you know, there's so many different areas to talk about when you talk about this. So I'll just go with one that is often, people often look at like the dearth of faces and they think, okay, well, that's the problem. And honestly, like, I always go back to kind of historical truths, which is that in order for people to be in a place in the present, generally they would have had to be welcomed in that place, in that space in the past, as a kind of, okay, you did it, you were allowed to do it, now we're going to do it because we feel comfortable doing it. And for so many years of our history, our country's history, the world's history, like, Black faces, Black bodies weren't welcome in these spaces. They weren't welcome on the stage. They weren't welcome in the audience. They weren't welcome in the buildings. They weren't welcome in the cities, frankly. And so you really do have to look at that, because people are like, well, isn't it just about the music? It's not really about race. But actually, everything was about race if you happen to be Black in America, you know, for the last 100 years. So, like, that meant everything. Mm-hmm. Like, what you were able to do as a profession, what you were able to study in school, what you were able to, once you did so, what you were able to do with that talent and that job in the world, in the space of the world. So that's kind of where it all comes from for me. I mean, I think that's to kind of ignore that and to say, well, you know, people aren't really interested in classical music or something like that, is to kind of miss the big picture, which is that even when I was growing up in Chicago, the only reason I got an opportunity to play music was mainly because there was a music program started specifically because music was taken out of the public schools in Chicago. Public schools in Chicago, predominantly Black and minority. Of course, they always say it's because of budgetary reasons, but I think it's other things. You know, there were people leaving these neighborhoods, and all the kids used to get music education in the cities, until all the kids living in the inner city happened to be Black and brown. And so this program kind of allowed me to study music at a really high level. And it's kind of part of the reason I'm here, because my parents also believed in arts and music education and all of that other stuff. Those things aren't accidental. They're connected to that concept of the value in the world and where value is placed in the world based on issues surrounding race and class and economics, socioeconomic issues. So that's kind of one angle to take about it. And so I think that what's happening now, and I see people attempting to do it, is to address a lot of those issues, address just equality and equity and inclusion when people are welcome onto the stage, inviting more different people to, like, be a part of the community of orchestra and welcome and kind of find ways to welcome in communities, even though they weren't welcome before. And so I think certain organizations and certain people are realizing the value in that. It's like, okay, well, we've made lots of mistakes in the past. How do we rectify that? And so I do see that some people are trying to think about that. Others are not.
Thank you. And I think that allows us a nice segue to your album, American Stories, which, when this airs, will be out on Sadia Records. These stories, some of them also deal with absence and displacement. Is that fair to say? Some of the works for this album, and certainly also from voices that may not be heard to the wider classical music audience.
Yeah, it's really interesting, you know, how this album came together. And of course, why we named it American Stories. For the last few years, of course, I've been thinking a lot about who we are as Americans, who we are as citizens of this country. Part of that has been kind of connecting with so many different people and people being allowed to tell their stories, but your story might be totally different than mine, but how do we come together for shared values and shared beauty? as human beings. And I think that the composers on this album, their own personal histories, but also what's kind of embedded in each individual piece that has kind of a story behind it, and how I met the Pacifica Quartet and I met them there in the music, and kind of wanted to share that with the world. And I think that's what this is about. This is like, we're all so different. We're all so different, but that's kind of like what makes us interesting and beautiful and talented and expressive as Americans, I believe.
Yeah, and it's supposed to be at least part of the American experience, right? Of this disparate yet shared experience.
Yeah, completely. And I think music is a good place to start with it, because people think about American music, you can't just really point to one thing and say, okay, that's it, you know?
Sure.
No, you can't, because everyone's so different. Everyone's come from different places, different backgrounds, and especially in American classical music, it's actually very rich because of like our totally different identities, geographically, racially, along religious lines, all of these things. That's what makes us, you know, who we are. And that's what makes our music what it is. And that's actually very uniquely American in a beautiful way.
Musically speaking, listening to this album, I was naively reminded of how well clarinet pairs with string quartet in terms of the tone and the texture, the readiness of the clarinet and the ruddiness of the strings, this overlap in pitch field. And that was a great chamber music reminder for me of this special pairing.
Yeah, I mean, that's really kind of you to say. I mean, because I think so. I think it blends beautifully. That's why I love playing with string quartet. I mean, it's something, I think it's what I do the most in my life. You know, those blendings of the sounds can be jarringly different at times, but also, you know, the sound in the low register of the clarinet paired with the cello. I mean, there's nothing.
Yeah. Sometimes you literally can't distinguish those two instruments for a moment. And that's a very special trick to pull off.
Right. I know. It's like, it's pretty cool to do that.
Are there different priorities for you when you're in a chamber setting like that, as opposed to in a principal clarinet New York Phil situation?
Yeah, I think the priorities are just slightly shifted. They're similar priorities, but they're just in the way they're executed are a little bit different. So, you know, when I'm on the stage with like 90 other people, you know, I have to work, of course, a bit harder at listening across the stage, trying to figure out who I'm playing with, who I should be in tune with. And sometimes that's more challenging than, say, trying to tune with a violist that's sitting, you know, 2 feet away from me. So that's the main difference. I think you're listening in kind of similar ways. When you're in the larger group, of course, at times you're definitely not the most important voice. You're kind of trying to blend in there, and you're completely buried sometimes in the orchestra. You're never really going to be, your sound is buried sometimes. But obviously that's not going to happen when you're playing with four string players. So that actually makes it a lot of fun. Like, how do you come back in the balance? How do you recede in the balance in a quintet versus an orchestra? It's very easy to get lost in an orchestra sound. But how do you do that and allow the violinist to come through or the cellist to come through in a quintet? So the level of sensitivity is actually heightened. The amount of soft playing that you can do is, for me, just the most enjoyable thing to do in chamber music. When you do it in orchestra, basically the whole orchestra has to drop out and there has to be a clarinet solo there.
We're back to Pines of Rome.
We're back to Pines of Rome and Sibelius I and all those pieces where no one else is playing. In quintet writing, clarinet quintet writing, you obviously get many more opportunities to play with the sweet, softest sound of the instrument.
There's one work I'd like to focus on specifically, which is Shotgun Houses by Valerie Coleman. I love the energy of this piece, and I think it's always hard to instill a programmatic arc to chamber music, given the forces that you're working with. But I really buy the Muhammad Ali narrative in this piece, married with East Louisville. What can you share with us about your experience with shotgun houses.
I discovered this piece just during the pandemic. All the other pieces on the album are world premiere recordings, but this was premiered by the Harlem Quartet. And they invited me to play a streamed performance during the pandemic with them. And I just fell in love with this work, with this piece, because there are so many different connections. And like you said, with the story behind it, not only the story of Muhammad Ali and Cassius Clay and what he represents as far as pride and identity and nationalism goes, and success and talent, international success and talent, but Valerie's history, Valerie Coleman, who's the composer's history. And I didn't know that, you know, her family knew their family, and they she's from the same neighborhood. All of these kind of little connections like that were really interesting to me. And I think the music is infused with this energy, as you mentioned, but also this like personal sound. And I know Valerie's music because I've recorded some of her other pieces and have played some of her other clarinet works, and it's all in there. And it's like that started getting us thinking about what is the composer's own personal history and identity. How does that get wrapped up in the way they express music? And then on top of that, you have this great picture of these actual historical moments with Muhammad Ali and these victorious sounds and these battle scenes and all of these things that we do and composers do in operatic music and scores and things like this that we all understand. But to have that be have such a picture, even without a narrator, how music can tell that story. We always talk about music telling a story and how it can do that, but to have it really do that, as you mentioned, is so rare. And I think it's just fun to play. So when I'm on stage playing that piece with the Pacificas, like, and I'm like moving in my chair, kind of battling, kind of fighting, weaving and bobbing and weaving while I'm playing, it's
Ali style.
Yeah, exactly. It's like I'm channeling my my inner boxer. You know, I mean, I know, I don't know if they have a weight class for my diminutive height, but, you know, if I could be.
You can rock out in the featherweight division. You can
Right? It's a lot. Yeah. I just went to the gym this morning, so, you know, I have a little bulk on me. But it's fun to do that with music. It's a lot safer, I think, to participate in that kind of in boxing when you're playing clarinet.
I see that you are performing the U.S. premiere of an Esa Pekka Salonen work, which I will let you pronounce.
Oh, I'm not going to give it a go.
All right, I'll say it. Kinema. Let's just leave it at that.
Yeah, that's
the Finns can correct me in the comments. Salonen's one of my favorite guys, both at the podium and as a composer, for his voice. Did you learn anything in your experience with this piece, or is it something yet to come on the season?
Oh yeah, it's coming in February, actually. I just know that he writes some of the most gorgeous and fantastical music for clarinet, but also some of the most difficult music for clarinet. And so there's always a challenge there, but it's always like, it's playable. it's just, wow, it takes so much intensity and so much focus. But he writes these gorgeous, gorgeous, talk about great clarinet writing. I think some of the orchestral works that I'm going to channel that he wrote, one of them is Nyx. It has, talk about a huge clarinet solo. It just goes on for like multiple pages. And at the end of this beautiful, lyrical, challenging, technical clarinet solo, it ends on a high C, which he throws in there. And I think this concerto also has things like that. It's like you play for, I don't know, 20 or so minutes, and then it ends on the highest note possible for the instrument, you know, just because. And so as far as the great composers always were able to demonstrate an instrument's capacity for everything, technique, beauty, warmth, pain, lyricism, articulation. And Esa-Pekka does that. He's exploring what are the expressive capabilities of this instrument. Fortunately, he wrote a piece for clarinet and strings, because just that sound alone is so expressive, and to expand it in the concerto form, you know, from something smaller like a clarinet quintet, as we discussed before, is wonderful. And I'm so glad that he asked me to do the US premiere. So I'm not nervous at all.
Okay, well, I'll take us out with my favorite Esa-Pekka Salonen joke, which is, what is the difference between a Finnish introvert and a Finnish extrovert? The Finnish introvert, when he's speaking to you, he looks at his shoes. And the Finnish extrovert, when he's speaking to you, looks at your shoes.
Well, I found that funny. I'm not sure anyone else will. So,
but that's all right. That's all right. This is all for us, you know? You've been listening to Soundboard, the Steinway & Sons podcast on artistry and craftsmanship. We heard a clip from Shotgun Houses by Valerie Coleman on the album American Stories on Sadia Records, the latest release from clarinetist Anthony McGill and the Pacifica Quartet. Our intro music is Philip Glass's Mad Rush, performed on a Steinway Model M by me, Ben Finan, editor-in-chief at listenmusicculture.com. Our outro music is Ottorino Respighi's Pines of Rome, performed by the New York Philharmonic under the baton of Alan Gilbert on the New York Philharmonic label. Question for the podcast? Email me at info@steinway.com with the subject heading Soundboard. Message me on Facebook at Steinway, or hit me on the gram at Steinway & Sons. Subscribe to Soundboard on Spotify, Apple Music, Deezer, or wherever you pod your casts. Thank you for listening. Thank you.